This is an ESO and Dude Letter production. This week, we watched On Her Majesty's Secret Service, and some of you may be asking, is this even a Bond movie? Why, yes, in fact it is. This is the one where Sean Connery didn't come back, and they hired someone else only to have him come back the next time because it didn't go well, even though the reviews were generally good. Very good for how weird this movie is. So, yeah. So, iTunes, Facebook, you know the routine. Let us know. Thanks, guys.
Topic.
Red leader, I'm
no, I'm sorry.
Stay on topic.
I can't say it. It's up to you, Red 5.
Oh, God. So, promo.
The Roundtable. Brought to you by Revolution SF. Tough love for sci-fi. Available at revolutionsf.com and iTunes.
Welcome to Mission Briefing. This week, we unfortunately had to watch 1969's On Her Majesty's Secret Service. This week on panel, I'm Nick Hoffman, host of Myopia Defend Your Childhood and editor of DudeLetter.com, and we have...
Steve-O.
And...
Matt.
Yeah. Man. This was the worst.
So we watched a movie, I think.
It's a long one, guys.
We watched a lot of something.
It was a lot of something.
And, you know, we talk about how, you know, even the worst Bond movie can be fun because we like Bond. This movie was a slog.
Not to say there weren't some fun parts, but...
No, there were some fun parts. I'll give him that. But it was...
There were some fun ideas, for sure.
So this movie, we should... Well, we'll do what we normally do. We'll start before the cold open. We'll start with the cold open rather than we'll get into the plot.
Yep.
This cold open starts without Bond. This might be the longest we go without seeing Bond since Dr. No.
Well, we see him silhouetted pretty early on, but...
Yeah. Well, first we start in M's office.
Yes.
And Bernard Lee is talking to Desmond Llewellyn. And Desmond Llewellyn has come up with a new invention, which is...
Radioactive lint.
Lint, yes.
That's right.
Yes.
Your microphone has fallen completely down.
Oh, yes, it has.
And the radioactive lint, he thought would be toxic? Track?
You can track people.
You can track people.
Pick up on the radiation, and you can tell where they are from their pocket lint. Or, you know, it's fine. Radioactive lint is subtle, right? That's what spies need.
Yep.
I like the idea, too, that it's not like... a fabric that turns into radioactive lint. You have to literally plant lint on someone else.
And I didn't put that together. I thought it was going to be like a polonium sort of deal where you're like, oh, let's just slip lint into this person's jacket and it'll slowly kill them.
Yeah, but nope, they didn't even go that far. The idea kind of half wore off midway through. And then we see Bond chasing a woman through a countryside.
Yep.
And this is one of the longest we go before... Well, I say the longest... They're teasing Bond out, and they're teasing Bond out because Bond has been replaced with George Lazenby. This is the first one after You Only Live Twice, where Sean Connery retires, and we end up with this. I think he was previously unknown. I don't think he had really acted beforehand, really.
His credits. I'm not sure.
So what do you guys think? I guess this is the first place to start, of George Lazenby as James Bond.
I don't think he was given a fair chance.
I don't think, yeah, I agree with that completely. They didn't establish that this guy was a Bond, in my opinion. He was just this new guy. He's a handsome guy. He's not the Bond image that I imagine. He was just a guy, and he was thrown into this role, and they said, damn it, be Bond, you know? We don't have Bond anymore. You have to be Bond.
Just to note, this does look like his first movie.
And he said, please, pile the cliches on my shoulders, and I'll wing it. And he did, and we're going to talk about all that.
Well, I mean, we'll get to it, like Steve said, but everything that you can think of that established Sean Connery as Bond, over five movies, they cram into one here.
Yes.
And it's rough.
And not only cram into one movie, they cram into the first, like, 15 minutes of the movie.
And it's like a checklist because he's like, he gets a cocktail, he's playing Baccarat, he's driving on a mountainside, he's in a very oddly shot action scene.
Yep.
All within, what, the first 20 minutes. Though, again, you could cut the first 45 and not miss a thing.
Yes.
Then we get Bond rescuing a woman who is a Contessa. Whose name is something. Tracy. From yes. drowning.
That was very... So was she committing suicide? Was that the thing?
That was the implication, but we never... There was no motive, so we just assume...
Okay.
Hopefully Bond is rescuing this woman and not just snatching random women up off the beach.
Yeah.
Well, and it's weird because... Then he gets knocked out by two bodyguards of hers, presumably, because we think we see them later.
At that point, yes, presumably.
And then, question mark. She ends up,
she runs away.
Takes his car to the top of the hill to get back in her car,
mm-hmm.
and then drives off to this Portuguese casino, I guess, is where they are?
Yeah.
At which point we have our Baccarat scene.
Mm-hmm.
At which point she immediately loses 20 grand, cannot pay, so Bond pays for her. And then he gets the crap beaten out of her in her hotel room.
Yep.
This is going to be a rough one, guys, because it's not... You Only Live Twice, where a lot of stuff happens, but it's kind of fun and light. This is a slog.
A lot of stuff happens. We don't know what half of it is or... What's happening or what it means?
Well, in retrospect, the beginning of the movie does make a little more sense because it's setting up
Draco Tracy.
And Tracy.
And Tracy is, you know, this is actually in book order. This is the third book. And, you know, this is a woman he loves. Tracy is someone he loves. And they have to establish her real quick, like. And so, I don't know. Maybe Ian Fleming thought this was going to be like an ace in the whole movie. Like, this is such a good script. This is such a good idea. This is, you know, even if it's a new Bond, they're going to fall in love with this Tracy character. They're going to fall in love with this Bond. Because they're tried super hard at some points.
Yeah.
All for naught.
So I thought this was one of the few, you know, really good points about the movie, in my opinion, was sort of the villain motivation or kind of, you know, what's the overarching story here. So let's actually get into that, you know. So what is this movie about? About Bond, obviously.
Well, right. I mean, so there's two simultaneous plot lines here. First, there is Draco, right?
Yep.
Draco is the Contessa's father, and he figures that Bond is in love with her, and that Bond is the person to help her settle down. And this becomes important because he is like the second biggest
crime boss
in Europe, and Spectre is the number one. And so he has all the motivation in the world to help Bond bring down Blofeld. Bond, after this cold open, is taken off Operation...
Ooh, it had a dumb name.
It did have a very dumb name. Operation Gumball Machine. And
it was like Midfly or something. I don't know. It's not that.
It was barely worth
mentioning. Operation Irrelevant.
Operation Plot Device. And when Operation Plot Device falls apart, you know, Bond decides to literally resign. He tells Moneypenny, I'm out, we're done, we're finished. And what she actually gives him, after a quick shot of Bond's office, which I guess we can talk about because it's kind of nice, we find out that Bond is been essentially taking 2 weeks vacation to figure out what's going on.
Well, I think we get a little more setup than that. It is Operation Whatever was the operation to find Blofeld, and he just recently found new information on Blofeld from Draco, potentially. Like, he has a source, which I guess he hasn't really had as of late.
Yeah, his attorney in Bern.
Mm-hmm. And what was the attorney's name? Does anyone...
Gumbolt. That's why I thought it was Gumball.
So he finds out that Gumbolt knows Spectre somehow from Draco, and then he gets taken off the case, and he's like, well, damn it, I'm going to go do this on my own.
And so he's going on quote-unquote vacation, which frankly, M must know he's going to go hunt down Blofeld anyway.
Yeah.
Because he's like, you know, if you're going to do this, we're not going to help you, but... I mean, really, like, it's Bond, for God's sake. It's not like he's going to be subtle about it.
And I did like the Bond, Moneypenny, M interaction where, like, Moneypenny covers them on both ends. Like, she's like, oh, you don't really want to, you know, leave, and then that sort of stuff.
And you know, Moneypenny actually matters in this movie.
Yes.
As opposed to Q, who does not matter one bit. frankly, I was not surprised. I would have been surprised if like something didn't explode because he was so passive aggressive towards the Bond the whole time.
If you honestly though, if you blinked, you'd miss him in the entire film. It's really depressing, frankly.
Well, because at the beginning, you're so used to him having gadgets and talking to Bond, and so if he didn't have his radioactive pocket lint, it's just an old man talking to another old man having an English competition. Though they don't win the most English person in this movie.
No.
When they get to the heraldry shop or whatever the hell.
The College of Arms and what was it called? Heralds and Arms or something like that?
Arms and Heralds, I think. Yeah, I think you got it.
Which was awesome.
Which was awesome. Which was the most English thing. Oh, my goodness.
So this was a weird omission for me because I've always loved those scenes with Q because you see all the, you know, you see all the gadgets. You see the stuff that really gets you excited about spy films. And this is a brand new actor. It's a new Bond, and we need to establish him as a Bond, right?
Yeah.
And that scene, it just isn't there.
No.
Like, where are his cool gadgets?
And that's a really important interaction for Bond, his interaction with Q. Like,
you have no idea what are the capabilities of this Bond. We don't know what gadgets he's got.
And frustratingly, the most we see of the gadgets are when he's going through his desk after he thinks he's resigned, and he's pulling out the gadgets in his desk. Yeah. You know, flat pack throwing knives from bandoliers and belts, and
we got the little breathing device from Thunderball.
We have some of the old watches where he's just pulling out garrote wire, and you just realize that there's some better movies.
And speaking of referencing old movies, I think we kind of glazed over the title sequence.
We did, because it was atrocious. So, not unlike Dr. No, this one has no lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
It's a theme, and it's kind of a mundane theme. It I think it appears more in GoldenEye later, and in the video game GoldenEye.
I felt like I had definitely heard it. You had said GoldenEye, I'm not sure, but I'll take your word for it. So,
it just sounds like the kind of thing they were playing in the bunker.
Yeah.
You know, the bunker levels. As a side note, I noted that, when they first get to the Spectre Lair, Blowsham's Allergy Clinic, there is a midget who is cleaning the floors, and he's whistling Goldfinger. Did you notice that?
Yes.
Very enthusiastically whistling.
Yes.
And it was so funny because there's no other music in the scene, and he's just like whistling Goldfinger.
Well, you may as well have diegetic midget whistling.
And it's, of course, the one with Odd Job, and you're just like, yeah, I get it. Yeah. No, I get it. Mm-hmm. I get it. Thanks.
So this title sequence was essentially various silhouetted hourglasses with shots from old movies with Sean Connery, like the old Bond movies, and it was just kind of random scenes from the old Bond movies and really not much else.
Well, and they're establishing former characters except for Bond, as though they're saying, this Bond is a part of the same timeline, guys.
Wait, no, he's still the same person, guys. Don't worry.
I mean, and it's all of them. It's Goldfinger, it's Dr. No, it's Hans, it's just everyone. Everyone just shows back up, apparently, which is, that's something.
But even compared to the older ones, like, it just looked bad.
It did. It looked lazy.
Yeah.
It looked more like a movie trailer for a box set.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and what's worse, of course,
it's like a clip show, basically.
Yeah. And you know, we've seen shots from other movies before in these, but usually, since it was always Sean Connery, it was not as jarring. But B, the music was better. There's nothing even happening. This is rough. This is really rough. And it doesn't feel like it belongs in this movie, especially after the first fight scene, which is pretty and colorful and oddly shot. With a lot of quick cuts and like things out of focus in the background, but it was still shot. Like, I don't know. This movie feels more like an Italian art film at times than it does a Bond movie. And it's 2 hours and 20 freaking minutes long. It is long. Did I mention that? I feel like I've mentioned it, but the movie will remind you of it.
I know that about 40 minutes in, I was like, Nick, how long has this been on for? Because literally nothing has happened yet. Like, we've learned one important detail of the movie.
Yeah, and it was, it was when he resigns.
Yes.
That was the only thing we'd learned by that point.
Well, he resigns, and I think he, like, meets with Draco or something.
Yeah, and Draco says, I know you've had sex with my daughter. That's okay. After he gets kidnapped wearing the worst golf outfit I've ever seen.
You didn't like the orange tactile neck?
Oh, my God.
I liked it.
I did, too.
I was digging it, for sure.
Well, it was definitely something, that's for sure.
So then, where were we? Let's go ahead and
advance this plot somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, like, what happens?
I think conversation with Draco is the next important
thing.
Okay,
what happens
really
with the conversation with Draco?
So, well, we kind of talked about it a little bit already, but Bond gets kidnapped by Draco's henchmen, who we don't really know who they are yet. They're these mysterious guys. They take him from the airport. Then he shows up at this dude's lair, I guess mansion.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just starts kind of vomiting nothing at him for a little while.
Oh, man. He has this soliloquy about his childhood, his family, his daughter, and it goes nowhere.
At least Bond... Doesn't Bond make the comment, like, why are you telling me this?
Yeah. Yeah, what's the point? Yeah, no, he definitely gives him shit for bullshitting him for 20 minutes.
But there we set up the bargain where Draco says, look, if you marry my daughter, I will tell you this information about Blofeld, because I know something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we get the lead.
And what's interesting here is... he is offering Bond to marry his daughter for, was it 100 million pounds?
Million pounds.
A million pounds.
A million gold.
And that's, I mean, it's a lot of money, and it's a very weird request.
It is.
From a mafia person to, about his daughter.
Yep.
And what else, this is a weird movie because Diana Rigg, the person who plays Tracy, is an actress who plays a spy in another franchise. She was in the original Avengers. She was Emma Peel.
Ah.
And so you'd think, hey, maybe she'll be doing some spy acting. Nope, she's just walked all over this whole movie. This is...
I rather liked her character.
Well, you believe Bond falls in love with her by the end.
Yeah.
And she kind of holds her own playing the femme fatale character, even against Ernesto Blofeld. Spoiler, who shows up 90 minutes into this movie, too.
Blue Chomp, what was it?
Beauchamp.
Beauchamp, excuse Beauchamp. Me.
Yes, the French pronunciation of Blofeld. This is an English Bond, although he does walk around in a kilt for a bit to remind us that Sean Connery was Scottish and he's not.
Yep. And as a child, I never understood that. I was like, why the hell is this man wearing a kilt?
And every shirt he wears is ruffled.
Yeah.
Every shirt. Even the one he dives into the ocean to save Tracy is ruffled.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we get this kind of exposition, and Beauchamp is, well, we have to get to how we know he's Beauchamp, because yep. This movie plods along. It's
okay, so let's just go ahead and speed this up. So he gets the information from Draco in one way or another that this lawyer, Gumbalt, has a connection with Blofeld or Beauchamp, whatever it is.
Yeah, at a bullfight in Spain.
Yep.
And he realizes that Gumbalt is an attorney who's done some work for him. And so Bond sits down. Well, Bond breaks into Gumbalt's office in Bern, Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
after having the longest, most bizarre romantic montage with Tracy, which involves four outfit changes and the most 60s music video for a song called Why Can't Every Day Be Christmas? Is that when that one comes in?
I don't know.
It was really cringeworthy. This is not a scene that belonged in a Bond
movie. It was upsetting, actually.
Well, and this soundtrack, you know, again... Every other Bond movie is known for this one song, for the one song, the titular song. Even Dr. No, they first play the Bond theme there, and it matters. It feels like it has weight. This one is nothing.
It's nothing. I don't remember any original scores from this film at all. No. I can't name one.
It was a breath of fresh air when all of a sudden the da-da-da-da kind of strikes up. Yeah,
the one time it came in, it was great.
Time, yes. And we have... and so he breaks into Gumbalt's office, and this agent of presumably Draco's puts this chest...
Which I guess is the one gadget of the movie?
Yeah, it's like this construction... It looks like the kind of thing they carry concrete to the top level of a building in. And in it is this...
It's a big crucible.
Yeah, there you go. Yep. There you go.
It is. It's in a briefcase which has a very fancy scanner, which also can crack safes, so we can break open this safe. And
so how does Bond pass the time while he's waiting for the lock?
Oh, yes. Oh,
that's right.
He cracks out a Playboy and starts reading it, and we see him like very kind of pervy looking through the centerfold, now, which he takes with him.
In establishing a new Bond character... as a person who is generally relatively suave as a character, like figuring through a Playboy and going like, "Ooh, awkward facial expression. Oh, that woman looks nice." Like, are you kidding me?
Again, it's one of these situations. I hate to be the guy who writes the fan fiction or rewrites a movie But what he should have done is gone to Gumball's liquor cabinet, just like they did in You Only Live Twice.
That's right. Made himself a drink, of course.
Yeah.
Made himself a drink and been disgusted at the vodka he has or something, you know? Because we get him ordering the Dom Perignon 57. We know Draco knows that he wants the shaken, not stirred martini.
Yep.
He even knows what kind of drink Draco wants. That's a much more Bond scene. The idea that Bond reads Playboy is just wrong. It just doesn't fit. Like... one way or another, Gumball has the forms that that Beauchamp, well, Blofeld has hired him to make sure he gets his heraldry, proving that he is an English count, and as a count, apparently he gets to be above certain laws.
I really don't know why that was such a big deal. And actually, M, later in the movie at some point, said, like, I don't really get why he cares that much about this.
It was a big deal, though. It wasn't explained why.
No.
It's just you kind of felt this weird weight of, this is a really important plot point that we're kind of going to get into.
Well, and maybe it's an English thing. I mean, obviously, because we don't have nobles here by definition. But, like, I can't imagine trying to explain this to a child. Well, isn't Bond dating a Contessa? Kinda, yeah. So is this just to be the... it's baffling. Blofeld's actual plot, though, is even more bizarre.
Yep.
It's a Manchurian candidate situation. He has a bunch of women of various ethnicities that are going to end up all over the world. And they're trained Manchurian candidate assassin types. And he has this deadly virus, which is just thrown away. They spend hours on this heraldry thing. But the fact that he has a poison or virus or whatever that he's going to spray out of atomizers at people around the world is glossed over in 30 seconds.
It is. Yep. They don't... The absolute epitome of tell and not show. They didn't show us anything. What are the ill effects of this? We don't know. It's going to kill everything. Don't use the atomizers. It's full of poison.
Which is what he tells them in a subliminal message, effectively.
Yes.
What would have been great is, again, it's the benefits of a newer Bond, but like, a guy holding the vial of it drops it and just melts.
Yes,
right?
Which we get in Moonraker.
We get in Moonraker, exactly. We do get a crazy mad scientist throwing a vial at him that explodes and melts a hole in the door.
That's like the archetypal like alchemist RPG character, like, let me throw potions at you.
That's
like,
right.
This is great.
That was the most action-packed scene. I loved it. And that was the one really atypical thing, and I wish they had done more of that. This is a new Bond. We need some new villains. We need some guys crazy enough to pick up vials of acid and just huck it at you while you're shooting at them. These are the kind of guys that Bond really needs to get into a psychological warfare with.
Yeah.
Well, and then you have, again, weight to the insanity. You know, because like Bond in this movie, it's what? Bond only has a gun in the last 10 minutes of it? He doesn't shoot a bunch of guys. He throws a couple off of a cliff.
Well, the first, I mean, we try to keep track of the body count, which we don't really do very accurately throughout, but he kills the first guy like minute 150?
Yeah. Because, like, the guys like on the beach he fights keep getting back up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, it's weird because everyone else has guns and weapons, and, like, the first time he has a gun, he turns the corner and someone throws a vial of acid at him and dissolves the door.
I think my first tally on the kill count was with a ski.
Yeah. Which was great, but we'll have to talk about
that. Yeah, it was great, but it was after 3.5 hours, and it was a ski, so...
Yeah.
Next to title sequence, I just wrote shit and moved on.
Mine was crappy overlay of hourglass, ?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess the halfway point of this movie somehow is Bond pretends to be a member of this heraldry, whatever.
Yep.
The College of Arms.
Yeah, he's like, he fills in, he's pretending to be a genealogist, basically.
And, you know, because Blofeld wants to track back to his colonel-dom, I guess, whatever, fine.
Is this a service you would request? Or do they come and audit the people? We just need to make sure that you are royalty. We're going to do our, you know, bi-yearly audits.
Well, it sounds like they've ignored Blofeld's request and now they're investigating him. Right? Like, is this what it sounds like? Because it sounds like the lawyer's just filing paperwork.
Blofeld, we saw your inquiry on Ancestry.com. We're here to...
Again, it's the whole premise, therefore, is so English, it's almost unrelatable. Because, yeah. Like, I can understand space lasers. I can't understand why, like, he has his family crest everywhere, too.
And oh, yeah.
They even show off Bond's. It's like, mine has four gold balls.
Well, I know we were looking through that Bond by Design table book, and yeah. There was this big thing on the Blofeld family crest, and I was like, there are like 3 pages in this book on this. Why the hell does this matter? And I was like, oh, I guess it really does. It is everywhere.
Well, and I mean, so that means that I guess this is my buddy Scott, who's, you've heard of myopia before, watched this one with us. And he pointed out that the director of this one, this is the first Bond film he directed and the only Bond film. Whoops. But he had also been film editor and a second unit director on other ones. And as we talked about before, there really are some pretty shots. And, you know, I think this is the first Bond where he goes skiing in the Alps. And that's since become kind of an iconic Bond thing.
Is this the first skiing scene in general? I'm sure we've had a skiing scene already, right?
Can you think of one?
I don't know if I can, actually.
Because, like, I know after this it becomes, like, a staple. Isn't there one in Diamonds Are Forever? That's the next one. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just trying to think out loud, but, like, it's even a two-parter, which is a little much. But, yeah, I think it's well shot at points.
Yeah. At points, yeah. It's very well shot.
Sure. So Bond ends up going to north of Bern, Switzerland, where he ends up in the Alps, and he's trying to get to Beauchamp's allergy clinic. He's disguised as Sir Hilary Bray, attempting to claim to detect the title of Comte Balthazar de Beauchamp, which is Ernesto Blofeld in disguise. Although apparently Beauchamp is just French for Blofeld.
What is his disguise? He's not carrying the cat around?
Yes.
So we see the cat for half a second. Then the cat disappears. Presumably it died in the explosion.
Yes.
Is this the worst disguise Bond ever had? It's pretty rough.
It was hilarious.
Considering he turned Japanese in the last film.
Yeah, this was a Clark Kent disguise. It was like, I don't know, just change your clothes and put some glasses on.
It was literally a Clark Kent disguise. Yeah. He has the glasses on, too.
Slap on a kilt and wear some glasses.
Because this is your number one arch nemesis, and you're escaping by wearing glasses. That's rough.
Yeah.
Because he spends time face-to-face with Blofeld. But Blofeld is also played by different actors, so maybe...
And actually, who's the Blofeld guy? I wrote it down.
Terry Savalas.
Yes. He was great.
This might be my favorite Blofeld as a character.
Yeah. Well, and he actually really was a character in this, and previously you just kind of get whisperings of him. You don't really get too much of him. But
so what do you think of that?
I actually liked it. It was kind of odd, as Blofeld's character is not really hands-on when it's established.
Yeah.
And this was very hands-on.
He was very hands-on. He was skiing with guns.
Yeah. he was skiing with guns.
That's right.
He was causing avalanches.
He caused an avalanche with whatever the hell it was. The most, you know, the only gadget in the entire movie,
I believe,
that isn't explained. The handheld mortar, that's right.
Well, and it was just, and he also is the one with the plot this time, which is weird.
Yeah.
And it's weird too, because if I understand the movie correctly, and it ends with this weird scene, but Bond is helping another mafia leader, organized crime leader. I keep saying mafia, but although this guy is actually Italian.
Yes.
Become the most powerful organized leader by taking out Blofeld, right? Because we're down to the point where Bond is dealing directly with Blofeld, and Blofeld's directly running this plot.
Yeah.
And at the end, M is talking to him. He's like, so we only got 3 of your guys in that bank job. And he goes, yes, I bet you got away with a lot of gold, didn't you?
It was strange.
Finally meeting you face to face, Em. Just like
it's weird though, you know, because he is basically the mafia. But they make a point, in a couple of points actually, to kind of touch on. Well, this is all, he's on towing that line of legitimate business. Like he's compared to Spectre, this guy's 100% legit, of course.
But I mean, like what I wanted a character to be is more like Hagrid from in GoldenEye. Valentin, right?
I thought you were just going to say Hagrid.
Oh, no.
I couldn't remember. I feel like that's out of place in this movie.
Robbie Coltrane's character, like, in GoldenEye, right? Yeah. Where he's actually helping Bond because it helps him get to his own ends as well.
Yeah.
I would have liked just that little bit more of that, where, like, you know, where the guy's like, if you help me get Blofeld out of the way, we're both winning here.
Yeah.
But we don't really get that. He's like, oh, you're in love with my daughter. I'll do anything. Which is kind of how it comes across, which is weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can assume that the guy is not stupid, and it's like, hey, Bond's just going to take out Blofeld for me.
But Bond himself in this movie is pretty dumb, even though he manages to know everything about everything.
He does.
I mean, I started making a list.
Lepidoptery?
Lepidoptery. Because he goes up to him and goes, that species looks a little small. And he goes, I didn't know you were studied Lepidoptery. Actually, no, I think he goes, I didn't know it was in your stable of knowledge or whatever.
Something like that.
And doesn't he pick up, after beating the crap out of that guy in Tracy's room, he takes some caviar out, puts it on, and goes, oh, caviar, beluga from the sea. Yeah, like, and he names the region it's
does,
from.
He does, yes.
And he also identifies her perfume, and she goes, is there anything you don't know, James? Yep. And he goes, a little about women. Or something. Like, it's just so, first of all, it's one of the most contrivedly written Bond films. Also, I think it's because of the Bonds, he appears the most dumb. He doesn't ever portray his intelligence, so he has to sound smarter than he looks.
Yeah. Well, and we only have Connery at this point, but...
Well, and Connery just sounds more confident and intelligent, frankly. Yeah. And, like, I guess, again, we mentioned this. This is also the most Archer of Bond. Like, he looks like Archer.
He does.
He really looks like Archer, with the cleft chin and the strong jawline and looking more like a male model than he could actually do any of this fighting. Which is kind of disconcerting. After Sean Connery really looked like he'd beat the shit out of you in all of the last movies.
Yeah. Well, I think there were actually some moments where his fighting was kind of convincing, and there was others where it was like sped up oddly, and people were flying around, and
they kind of cut the speed on this thing, and then sped it up, and cut it, and then sped it up a lot. Although my favorite is the one where Bond is on his chest, sliding across the ice, and shooting his MP40 or whatever.
That was fabulous.
That was cool.
And the guys in the orange jumpsuits had no idea. These also had some of the best enemy uniforms.
Yes, they were nice.
You have the blue for Draco's men and the orange for, what's his name, for Blofeld's men. And one of them had the Olympics insignia stitched into it.
I think a bunch of them did, actually.
Did, yeah. Yeah.
Any idea why?
No.
Because, I don't know.
That's actually a very good question.
There was a Winter Olympics thing going on. There were, you know, there was bobsledding, there was skiing. I don't know.
But that wasn't set up at
no,
all.
No, it wasn't. It was just, you know, a mountain in the Alps. But
well, and it sounds weird to me because you'd think it'd be something either very expensive to use, right? You can't just use the Olympic logo. Or you'd think they were setting it up, you know, come to Castle Beauchamp for the 1970 Winter Olympics. Like,
maybe they had a big Olympics thing planned and then realized their movie was already 2.5 hours long. And then they had to cut all of it and still had the Olympics uniforms.
Oh, that would have been amazing. There's somewhere a director's cut that's 4 hours, like the extended Lord of the Rings.
Bond is competing in, like, the ski jump or something.
Oh, which happens at one point, I think.
Yes, it does.
Yes, it does.
I believe that's For Your Eyes Only, I think.
Yeah, that's a Roger Moore one, isn't
it?
Yeah, Roger Moore is someone who never left Pinewood Studios. Yeah, no, no.
Okay, so we should maybe talk about Beauchamp's lair and the women.
Yeah, so Hilly, as he calls himself to the ladies, shows up and pretends to have this terrible flight. Not a very good traveler, no, not at all. Most intolerable.
Not a sportsman.
Not a sportsman. Most intolerable. I'm a little airsick, yes. He has a pipe. He has this giant Sherlock Holmes overcoat, and he has glasses and a little houndstooth hat.
He looks very boogish.
Yes, he looks very not Bond. He meets Fraulein Emil Bunt, who is Frau Farbissina in Austin Powers.
Yeah, exactly.
And they ride up the mountainside in first a huge Mercedes and then in a helicopter to get to Beauchamp's lair, all the time followed by one of Draco's men in a VW Bug. Mm-hmm. Before he gets the crap beaten out of him several times and then shot at and then ultimately hanged.
This guy's great, by the way. If I can just segue and say that this was the grittiest, just most raw character in this whole film. And we don't even learn the dude's name before he's murdered. Spoilers. This is, by the way, the same guy at the construction yard that had the suitcase full of...
The scanner safecracker.
Exactly. So this is the same guy that's trailing Bond the whole way, and you kind of get the impression this guy's like his guardian angel right now. You know, he's working with Draco. He's going to watch Bond's ass.
Well, and it's you know, and to Steve's point, what's more, because this is the most Bond has ever gone off the grid, so to speak, and his first ally is this curly-haired guy who I don't think has ever established, like, by name.
No.
But he kicks ass. He gets into places, he plays the Bond game, and until he's ultimately killed and hung from somewhere outside the structure we don't see.
Yep.
So Bond gets in. to this lair, and it's like every other lair in every other Bond movie. He can't open the door on his own, although this one they figure out a way, and there's a kind of closed door farce where he's just hooking up with all the ladies.
It was weird.
It was weird. It was like a weird hostel thing. Like, a weird vibe going on about that.
You have a bunch of ethnic women, and they're all dressed in their ethnic clothing.
And they're conveniently all allergic to the most stereotypical food for their ethnicity.
And eating their ethnic food. Yeah, it was pretty 1969 in this part.
The black woman is eating bananas.
That was just offensive.
Actually eating bananas, yeah.
Yeah.
It was all the foods they were supposed to be allergic to, because the only one that we actually knew that for a fact was Chicken Lady, who now loves chickens.
Ruby?
I don't know her name.
Yeah, it was Ruby.
And the woman with with the Art Garfunkel afro. Yeah, who calls Bond Hilly, which we'll get to. That's,
he calls himself Hilly.
He calls himself Hilly, and he hooks up with her.
So weird.
This was a dignified nickname.
Yeah. So he's there, of course, to prove the heraldry. So he has all these heraldry books, and he's done his Bond research. So now, Bond, you can add to his list of things he knows heraldry, I guess. Yeah. And what it is, ultimately, is he's there to get close to Blofeld and find out all this information about him. But ultimately, there's a question mark here. Is he there to kill Blofeld, or is he there to find out what his plot is? Because at the end of the day, he does kind of neither.
And you would think, especially in the beginning of the movie, his goal was to kill Blofeld. Because M said something along the lines of, like, you know, you got to use your license to kill for something. It's been 2 years. Like,
and you haven't gotten any closer to him.
Yeah. And now he's in the same room with him? He could have shot him and ran away.
Yeah, and you know, and frankly, it's Bond, so you're like innocent women. But these aren't innocent women. They're time bombs at this point, designed to kill. If he had blown up the whole thing and just walked away, mission accomplished. Moving on. Next, Bond has killed women before in these movies. He'll do it again. It's not a big deal. This is weird. And this movie really protracts this. It's, oh my God. Okay, so Bond gets into this lair.
So we're in the lair.
And he's locked in his room, and he is told he'll come out at 7 o'clock, and so he changes into his kilt. And Bond is wearing the ruffliest of ruffles and cravats, and the outfits on this are the least dignified and have aged the worst of any Bond movie ever. Everything has ruffles. They tried to make Bond more contemporary, which doesn't work. The timelessness of the ones that are earlier and later are so much better looking. Ugh. Daniel Craig's suit will look fine in 50 years.
Yes.
Nothing this man wore will look okay. Because even, like, the kilts is weird. Like, because you wouldn't wear a ruffled shirt with it today. Like, it's just awful. Everything is awful.
Well, and I don't know my kilts, but it's still, like, is that what a kilt is?
I mean, the kilt I can't argue with because I don't know. And presumably, it's whatever, Bray, the Sir Bray's kilt. I mean, I imagine that exists. Mm-hmm. And frankly, Bond is also a Scottish name. I'm sure he has a kilt.
Yeah.
Fine. However... He should not have worn the rest of that outfit, although it does allow the women easy access to his crotch, which happens in a minute.
To his besants or whatever.
Yeah, to his golden besants. Balls.
Yeah, and so he's beguiling all the women by talking about heraldry, which immediately convinces them all that he's gay, apparently.
Yeah, and I didn't get that either. Like, I understand that the man apparently loves his heraldry. But just because you are passionate about your job, like, that doesn't mean that you are homosexual.
I think the term they use is not interested in women.
Maybe and that's what they thought his this. Allergy yeah. was.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. What is the allergy, well?
But was he acting that effeminate throughout that? Like, I didn't get that.
I didn't get it either. And apparently Rudy didn't either, because she immediately wrote her room number on his leg and lipstick, which she said was a stroke of genius. Apparently someone told George Lazenby he was really good at accents, so he had to keep cracking him out, lest Blofeld figured out. Weren't you Scottish in the last movie? Weren't you English? Yeah. So Bond ends up figuring out that Rudy is in room 8 after effectively flirting with all the women in the room through the talk of heraldry and 1438 and all that garbage. And he breaks out of his room using the metal in his ruler. This is a little bit of Bond, this.
Yes, it was.
Okay. He can't open the room on his own. Gunther has to open it for him. So he takes the metal edge out of a, you know, wooden ruler and shorts out the door so it opens up. And he's able to sneak down to room 8 where we see Rudy. She tells him his name, that she's from Lancashire. Because we're not allowed to know last names for whatever reason. Because, well, for whatever reason. Because Blofeld is training these women to be explosives, essentially. And he wants to make sure that Bond can't find them.
Mm-hmm.
Though we're not sure if he knows he's Bond yet.
He doesn't at this point.
Which is astounding.
Mm-hmm.
Astounding.
What tipped him off was his inferior knowledge of heraldry.
Sure did. Oh my god.
And the fact that he can't keep his hands off of anyone.
Yes.
Oh my god. So he nails Ruby, and you can see her boobs because the blanket comes off at one point, which was kind of jarring. This movie is the most nipple-friendly of all the Bond movies I think we've seen.
It's true. That is the second nipple up to that point. Convenient number.
Convenient number, yeah. And in the credit sequences, the Blu-rays really just make everything pop. Oh, come on. That was clever.
It was.
I
mean, in the least clever of ways.
Yes, in the least clever of ways. Also, to watch him try to take his shirt off involves unbuttoning from the back and then buttoning down the front, and then all of a sudden you see the kilt fall off, and she goes, "Oh my, you weren't kidding about those bezels or whatever." They
were. Did she say the rumors are true? Or the rumors are true.
It was atrocious. Which means maybe he has 4 balls.
That's a penis.
I don't know.
I done seen your penis.
Okay.
I'm not saying this movie's good, guys. No. It goes nowhere. From here, we get this weird kind of intercourse cut where he leaves the room, and then there's another woman in his bedroom, and he uses the exact same pickup line on her, because she wants to turn the light on, and he goes, "Oh no, you're much more radiant in the firelight."
That's right, word for word, exactly the same, and she almost responds the same way as well. It's kind of creepy.
It was very odd. Like, I don't know why they felt the need to have him use the same lines exactly.
I wonder if, in my mind it was to illustrate, because this is right after we have that scene with Ruby where it's kind of clear that there is some kind of mind control going on. Because
yeah.
You've got the scene where she's in bed and she's just kind of lying there submissively to these weird lights in the ceiling, and you hear, Blofeld's voice comes over the intercom and is convincing her that she loves chickens and has to spray, toxins in people's faces. So we already kind of had this notion that these people are kind of under his spell.
Yeah.
And that was the impression I got, is that Bond uses the same line on 2 women. It works in almost the same way on both women. And that kind of is just adding more fuel to that fire of these people are kind of mind controlled.
Okay, I'll buy that.
They're very malleable to persuasion.
Well, and it's of course funny because since the other woman is in his room, she's not being fed the mind control. But Blofeld has no way of knowing who's in the room because there's not cameras for some reason, which is weird.
Yeah.
Anyway, long story short, the next morning, Bond, dressed to be outside for whatever, a few hours, plays curling with the ladies, at which point he falls on his back. And everyone gets a good laugh. Sir Hilly. and we see Draco's man trying to climb, get on the gondola. They refuse him. So he climbs up the mountain in the next scene and is shot at. And Bond, of course, sees it and goes, "Oh, no. Oh, bloody."
It doesn't react at all. He kind of reacts. They show his face. But there's no sense of... You don't even get a sense for one second that Bond is going to do anything to interfere. He just kind of goes, "Oh, shit, that guy got caught. Okay, I'm totally
I guess
off.
I'm on my own now, yeah. And at this point, gets told to meet all, 3 different women, or 2 women, and the 2 women from before, and a 3rd woman, the Japanese woman who is allergic to rice. Yeah. To meet him that night.
Mm-hmm.
At which point, we have a cold cut. And it's presumably that night at 8 o'clock. He goes to meet Ruby again. And this time Frau Bundt is in the bed.
Horrifying.
And the lines he delivers
This was like that scene from The Shining where the woman turns into a decaying corpse. This is what Frau was in that bed. It was terrifying.
Well, and he goes, I hope that old something something didn't get to you first. I should have written that line down, but it was so like sitcom, like, I bet you that dumb Sarge isn't right behind me right now. And of course it was her in bed. I guess we glossed over the scene because it's boring as hell, but when Blofeld and him are talking about his Beauchamp heraldry, like, who could care?
I don't know, honestly.
I'm interested in your laboratories. And he goes, oh, we're not paying you for that, Mr. Bray. All right, next scene.
They had to meet, right? And I guess they set down some ground rules, kind of, sort of. We got to see the lab, which was kind of cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
The lab scenes were neat, and... you know, there's something about going to Augsburg after Christmas, you know, to really establish the timeline of this movie. This movie just slows to a crawl here, which it shouldn't.
You mean it wasn't already crawling at this point?
This part was better than, look, excluding the first 30 minutes, which were...
There's no good cut of this movie.
There's like, not. It's supposed to be Bond has infiltrated the enemy base. Things are supposed to be happening, but it's literally what would happen if Bond went to a really awkward resort. That's what this movie is so far.
But I mean, like, but that's what it is, like, because that's the difference, right? You know, it's traditionally when Bond gets to this point, Dr. No knows who he is, right? Goldfinger knows who he is. Whoever knows who he is. So when he's in the base, he's not really doing, you know, like, he's there, the guy's constantly trying to stop him, he's expecting people to shoot at him. Here Bond has to keep a low profile, so the action is kept down. You know, it's really like the first act of Goldfinger when they're at the same spa, right?
Yeah.
And Bond can kind of obstruct.
But they're trying to have Bond do some sort of, you know, intelligence gathering or something, but...
But that's not even happening. No. There's nothing clever. He's not setting traps. He's not trying to push people in certain directions to help him out later. He's just kind of mingling.
And I mean, he really was just like screwing women.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was his vacation.
It was odd.
Well, and it's all the odder because, you know, Beauchamp goes, what are we paying you for if you're just going to take the morning and afternoon off? Yeah, really. What are you going to do, Bond? Like, you have no plan here. You can't just drag this out forever.
This job's hard.
And all he's asking Beauchamp is like, would you like to vacation with me in Augsburg? We have to look at some records. It'll be fun. And you're just like, what the hell? Really? What the hell, man? So how does he know Bond is Bond?
So, now, I may be incorrect, but I believe that the detail that we mentioned earlier where we should go vacation in Augsburg because that's where the Blumchamp family tombs are or something.
Yeah.
And Blofeld is like, haha, I got you. That's not where they are. They're in this place. And I knew that, you know, if you were really this genealogist, you would know that. Plus, you wouldn't have had sex with all my patients. So.
I think that was the kicker.
Okay. I'm allergic to latex.
I didn't know who it was until you were sleeping with all the women, and then I knew it was Bond.
Yeah, really. I knew the second that you kept trying to put your penis in people.
Yeah, and it was weird, because not only does it not really fit with the Bond thing, but, like, why? 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 Where did he find these women? How did they end up at his place? Why did they stay? Like, none of it makes sense.
Well, I mean, he was curing allergies. They set that up.
Fine. How long were they there? Does all this happen in 2 weeks from Spain to Portugal to Switzerland? Because M is never concerned.
No.
When he shows back up at MI5 or MI6, he's like, I told you should have just stayed on vacation. Wait, is vacation's not over yet? Like, how long is this 2 weeks
two
gone?
Days later.
Like, and...
This is like watching 24 and you never see him go to the bathroom.
Right. You know, and at the end of the day, although Bond would have to have sex every episode. Drink three alcoholic drinks and have sex.
So intoxicated and so much fornicating that...
I'm allergic to latex, ladies. I'm going to keep saying that joke until someone laughs listening to it. So after all this, Bond is, you know, kind of, I guess, found out. He is captured. He is locked up in the room with the gondola gears.
Okay, so wait. Before, because there's a huge plot hole here, I think, and I think we want to touch on this.
Yeah.
So, you know, because Blofeld has been established kind of at this point as being a little more of a thoughtful you know, he's a little more of a thoughtful antagonist. He's covered all of his bases. He's a little more personable. Like, you just get the feeling this guy's got more integrity.
Yes.
And then he locks Bond up in a room full of the, you know, the gears that run the gondola, and there's a hole right in the wall where he can crawl out of, which he does later.
Yeah.
It just, it blows my mind.
I really didn't understand why he left him there.
Well, and the first thought he mentions is like, look, we have a bargaining chip now. Now you can tell them that we're not joking when we have a threat. Fine. You actually have a reason for the first time that you don't just kill Bond right off. But then you put him in the most easily escapable, like, there's literally a portal to the outside.
Yeah.
Which he uses.
I mean, at very least, you could expect him to try and break the gondola.
Like, why not just put him back in his room and then leave a couple guards outside because he knows how to get out? Or, like, cut the breaker to his room. I mean, I didn't need to go into reasons why, like, it was...
That's fine. So he's in the gondola gear room. He's
wearing
his
cardigan, and he tears the pockets out of his pants so that he can try to grip the cables. But again, this isn't Sean Connery. This is George Lazenby. And so whenever he grabs the cable, it starts moving him back in the other direction. And back in the other direction.
Well, he looks like a buffoon with like weird mittens on. I mean, it was not a dignifying escape.
It wasn't. This was another scene that Bond could have been a badass and could have been out of there in 2 minutes. But the scene was 10 minutes instead of him blundering around, gripping gondola cables, around.
I did like that, you know, he was timing how long the gondola run was, so he knew how long the gears would run for, and he was, like, trying to do that sort
That's
of
true.
Thing.
That was clever.
Yeah.
Well, and
that was one of the few instances of, like, what? He's using his brain.
Yeah.
Well, and again, that's Bond being a spy, as opposed to, you know, the Sean Connery way, which we've already seen him just jam something in the gears of, right, you know, and stop the machine. Fine, that works too. You're doing something.
Yeah.
But here, it became a comedy of errors where he kept trying to climb, and the thing kept moving the other direction, and he nearly gets crushed at one point. You know how at the beginning we were talking about Tracy? Don't worry, she's about to come back into this movie. Bond straps some skis on because he's chasing the women who he knows have been now brainwashed to. Well, he escapes. Here's Blofeld's last subliminal message when they're trying to open their Christmas presents, which is filled with a radio compact, 9 other pieces of makeup, which we don't get to, and an atomizer filled with a virus.
They gloss over a few details there.
You know, like, and it would have been so easy to do a scene out of something like, Charlie's Angels or something, where they just, it's all weapons, and they just open something, and there's a knife, and like, just little things. But no, don't touch the atomizer, it will be deadly.
No.
She just puts it back.
You're fine using the blush, though. That's okay.
The rest were just Chanel No. 5. Like, it was actually just perfume.
It was a shame. They needed that. They needed the montage. You know, was there one? I can't think of a good one.
And there should have been, and where each, they pan to all the different women to kind of show that the enormity of what Bond has to deal with, and one takes it out, you know, takes out weapon, just a different one each shot, and then you realize, oh, there's 20 of them, this is going to be hard, as opposed to the last shot where they were all flirting with him. That's a two shot, and that's a good two shot. Fine. All we get here is Fraulein Bundt with her cognac just with the snifter just like, oh, those ladies, and drinking from it.
It's it. There's nothing. Okay. So these women, obviously in Austin Powers, the women with the machine gun breasts are based off of these women.
Yeah, the fembots.
And you get a very clear sense because they shoot bullets out of their tits at things during the movie. You know they can do it. It's just another one of those scenes where I felt so disappointed that they took so much time to build these characters and say these women are one of the focal points of the movie. They're something to be really feared, and they never prove it, not for 1 second. Bond just has sex with 2 of them, and then they leave on a gondola in open presence.
And that's it. And the shame is, there's something you could have done with this movie.
Yes.
Right? Like, you know, you could have had... Well, we were talking about this earlier. How much better of a movie would it have been if... Tracy had been the one to infiltrate it, and she gets brainwashed, and so Bond has to convince her that, you know, this is the second tier where he has to come in and convince, like, that she knows him and that she's not, like, you know, to get to the bottom of this.
Yes.
Hell, even Ruby could have recognized Bond and been broken of the spell in some way, but no. How does this movie have an 82% on Rotten Tomatoes? It makes no sense.
Does it?
Yeah, it does.
Oh, I don't know about that.
That might make it the most overrated Bond film.
I'm not sure about that, Rick.
What's more overrated than this one?
Oh, no, I'm agreeing with you.
Oh, good, okay. I don't know.
I think the best part is the ski chase.
Yeah, so I think from this point on, and we're what, like at least an hour 45 into this at this point?
Yeah, there's still 45 minutes in the movie.
So the last 45 minutes were probably the best 45 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, it really picks up at this point. Yep. So do a lot of inconsistencies, but at least the plot's moving
okay.
And things are happening.
Things are happening. I can deal with that.
Yeah,
so Bond sees the women. They get on the gondola. They're going down the mountain with Fraulein Brumbund. And the idea here is that he has to get to the bottom of the mountain to stop them.
Yes,
you know, to get them before they scatter to the four winds. So what he does is he starts skiing, and this is where we get this beautiful skiing scene. It's broken up into two parts. So the first one is the night skiing, and he is wearing this kind of it's that same baby blue that he almost always wears.
Yes,
With
the largest bug-eyed ski goggles in existence.
Oh man, they would. I mean. Women, if you want the biggest sunglasses available, these take up 2/3 of his face. They're spectacular. He goes down the mountain being chased by some orange shirts. Eventually, also Blofeld.
Yep.
Who actually gets in on this. Going down the mountain. And trying to get to the town at the, I guess, the midway down the mountain. Because the mountain goes on for days. And days and days and days. At this point, we have a day for night scene where they're skiing down the mountain. Bond has no gun, but they have machine guns, so he's dodging and weaving. And
they shoot one of his skis in half, so he has to go one skied, which features some pretty awesome skiing, if I do say so myself. Whatever stuntman is actually doing that skiing, pretty impressive.
Yeah, because when they cut back to George, he is definitely back in Pinewood Studios being nice and warm. Bond kind of gets hit again going over this little ridge. And falls as guys come after him. The problem is, had he gone 5 more feet, he would have fallen off this cliff. So all the guys that come at him, he throws over this ridge.
Yep.
And they fall for about 3.5 minutes each. And they follow this guy.
The entire way down.
This is probably the best dummy we've seen so far because it falls like a person and it goes and goes and goes and goes and goes and then bounces when it hits the ground.
It was great. I loved it.
It was good.
I loved it. I loved it so much. It was good.
It was very Wile E. Coyote, except there was no explosion at the end.
Yeah.
Bond steals the second guy's skis.
Yep.
And then skis down the mountain to the little village, at which point he misses the girls. They get on their the weirdest looking little minibus I've ever seen.
All of them, too.
Like. All of them get onto one giant minibus that looks like they could stand up in it and be fine. But Fraulein Bunt gets the message that the Englisher has escaped. The Englander. Sorry, my German's just so rough. And so Bond steals someone's jacket and tries to blend into the crowd. He's watching the ice capades when all of a sudden he runs into Tracy, who has stalked him all the way to this one town in Switzerland somehow.
Well, we actually get an explanation for this. The fact that she happens to be at that ice rink is just... It doesn't make any sense, but... She was informed by Draco that his guardian angel was there. And I guess maybe he didn't report in or something. So he somehow knew the guardian angel was dead. And so she is there now looking for him, I guess.
Right. And Bond is, you know, pleased to see her, of course, because this means he has a car to get out of the way. And at this point, Bond has come completely smitten, forgetting about the two women he banged up on the mountain. And they are deeply, madly in love at this point, and she helps him escape in... Did we decide this was a Chevy Malibu or the Mercury?
It was a Chevy Malibu, and I was thinking it was a Nova, but a Nova looks like this with one headlight on each side, and the Malibu has two headlights on each side, so...
Yeah. So sassy. But no, so he gets away in the Chevy Malibu, and they're driving down the mountain out racing this until you get this whiteout snowstorm.
Which snow, that snow was falling like an inch every 2 seconds. Snow does not fall that fast.
This was a blizzard. Like, and the fact that they drive until their things freeze up is astounding. Although I guess that's kind of an English jab at American manufacturing. Of course, the American heating system stops working. But they break into this farmhouse.
Mm-hmm.
When they try to bang, the horses look away. Bond actually proposes at this point.
He does.
And says, "Oh, I love you so much, and we should save this until our wedding night." And although they've already had sex up in the hotel at the beginning, and I want to point out here,
we've been talking about an hour. She leaves the movie for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And it's jarring when she comes back because you're like, which woman is this again? Oh, yeah, Tracy.
That one.
I mean, and it makes sense now why they had all the love montages because she's going to come back. And if you'd seen this movie only for the first time in order to watch, listen to this podcast, you know, God bless you. Love you too. Thanks for following along with us. But this is a rough one if you hadn't seen it before because, man,
yeah,
she disappears and comes back. Like, there's two movies that happen here that kind of converge at the end. And then really converge at the very end.
Yes. We'll get to that at the very end.
Oh, that stops the movie. Oh, mm-hmm. It's so rough. The credits just... Ba-da. Oh, my God. Okay, so they get to this Swiss...
Lodge thing. Barn, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, and there's horses in there. Who knows where the people are? Should have had a Back to the Future scene where the guy just shows up. Who are you in this spacecraft? And just shot him. So they... You know, I've given it up for New Year's. Banging. And then he has sex with her anyway. Yada, yada, yada. The next morning, Estavro Blofeld is coming down the mountain, somehow finding them.
He is in a random barn in the middle of nowhere.
And as established, you might say, well, maybe they saw the tire tracks. No, no, no. It was snowing so hard you never would have seen a damn thing.
And Blofeld skis up to the barn?
They ski right up to the barn. This was the most disjointed scene for me.
It really...
And then there's this weird juxtaposition where they... Maybe I just blinked and missed it, but they, like, immediately cut, and Bond is skiing again, and Blofeld and his men are just behind them.
I believe that we get, like, a two-second shot of Bond jumping out of a barn window, I think.
Like, just, you know, as trying, trying to get his pants on last minute, jumping out a window. And
what we get is a two-shot from the cameraman, where he's looking out the front window and see Blofeld and his men, and they turn to the back window, and they're skiing out the back side.
Okay.
That's what it is. But yes, no, you're right. We don't get any establishing shot. We don't get... Frankly, what I would have assumed is Bond sitting up quickly, and then they pan out and see skiers, and then they're running to get out the door.
Yeah.
But this is as though Bond has telepathy, and he is just 30 seconds ahead.
Well, it almost looked to me like they just cut, and Bond incidentally happened to be skiing and not there at that moment. But no, he was there, and now there's another chase
scene. It was very disjointed.
Yeah.
And of course, they don't have to look for Bond. They just know. He's already gone.
And he's, of course, at the top of the Alps again, because he has another 6 billion miles to ski, because he didn't just drive down to a valley with a village in it.
But but I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. Shooting him didn't work. How do you stop Bond?
More bullets.
And then...
Ladies and gentlemen, they've got more bullets.
And just an avalanche, yeah.
And then a mortar. An avalanche mortar.
A hand mortar to knock an avalanche down. And this is brutal, because they keep cutting away, and then you see miniatures being torn up by this avalanche.
I think before we get there, what if the most gruesome deaths in any Bond?
Oh!
There's a big snowblower cutting a trench basically through the snow so people can walk or drive through it. So Bond and Tracy jump over it, and one of the henchmen fails his jump over it, falls into essentially a wood chipper.
I think it's worth noting this is the first henchman of, like, four that are going to attempt this jump. The first one messes up.
And then the rest keep trying.
And then he gets ground into this, and the wood chipper slash snowblower is shooting out, like, red snow, but it's not only red snow, there's like viscera in
there's
the
clumps.
Snow. Yes, there was like there are clumps that is clearly like organs and stuff, and Bond makes a joke like, well, I guess he didn't have the guts for this. It's like, are you serious?
He should have had a lot of guts.
Like, generally in these Bond movies, we don't get that gore. This is one of the few times.
And
like,
Bond's quips are usually at the expense of the henchman in Blofeld.
Yeah.
And oftentimes after he's been punched one too many times, he goes, oh, I think you missed the spot. You know, something like that.
Yes.
And here, it's very
this
much...
This was like Fargo wood chipper scene.
Yeah.
Like, it was ridiculous.
It was very Tarantino. It was like absolutely unnecessarily gory, and everyone just laughed it off.
Yeah. Well, and I know we watched this with some people, and so credit where credit's due. Aaron pointed out that one of the women had Princess Leia hair in the allergy clinic, and so this is where Fargo got its scene, and that's where George Lucas got Leia hair. It's gotta be.
Perfect.
Yeah, good. Wrapped up in a nice little bow here. But Bond and Tracy are caught up in the avalanche, and it's brutal. You just see, again, good dummy work here, because they are just thrown down this mountain.
Yep.
They take Tracy with her.
Which, again, I had a big problem with this.
Yeah, so the avalanche is settled, and they go to retrieve her, but
So he manages to find her in an avalanche with binoculars
yeah.
and then skis for like 20 seconds and gets to her. So yeah, he was totally avoiding the avalanche. And then 20 seconds away is now the person who has skied away from the avalanche.
He's a really good skier.
He's a really good skier.
And they go, what about Bond? He goes, don't worry about him. He's not getting out of that grave.
He's in an icy tomb now.
Exactly. Yarr. Oh, but let's go get the woman because she's right there on top of the snow.
And of course, immediately the second he skis away, we see Bond get up and you're just like, oh, of course we did. Bond goes to M and M's like, it's none of our business. We're going to pay the ransom. He's going to get immunity and his heraldry. Because that comes back then.
Yeah.
And Bond,
I thought was, like, Thunderball, we established that they don't negotiate with these sorts of people.
Yeah.
And M is like, no, we'll give Bond until the very last minute to try to foil this plot, and then we'll pay him off. This M was like, nope, screw you, we're just going to pay him off.
Well, the other side of this, too, is Bond's life, it's been very clear, is effectively expendable, mm-hmm. right? That's what he is. He's a spy, and if he dies for the cause, he dies for the cause. Here, they're like, yes, we're going to negotiate with Blofeld Inspector, and we're going to give him his heraldry, and we're going to make him immune from all of his previous crimes, which is bullshit, because he's about to cause a huge, major international incident.
Yes. And it's not like they weren't going to nuke everyone in Thunderball. Like, it's not like that doesn't matter.
You know, and we'll get to the other plot hole at the end of this, but these women get away.
Yes.
All of them.
We assume. We never see them again.
Because he takes five pictures, and there were 20 women.
Yeah.
And so he knows where five of them are.
Speaking of which, I loved the scene where he was taking the pictures of all the women with his tiny spy camera, and he needed the gigantic copier for the documents.
Hey, it was also a safecracker, and they saved huge money on that because they bundled it, all right?
Today, bundle your safecracker with your scanner right. and save 50%.
I would have loved it. I loved that there was a safecracker in the previous film we watched, but this one had analog numbers.
Yes.
They weren't digital anymore. They went back a step.
And the other one fit in his pocket.
Yep.
It was,
It was really funny.
So, then we have this weird sequence in which Bond kind of puts the phone up to his head and goes, ah, Mr. Draco. Ah, gee, who is this? Bond. James Bond. The second time he gets to use the line. And he goes, I have a construction job for you. Oh? Yes, and it requires some lift.
Yeah, it was like it's demolition, and it has like aerial requirements, and like.
And then we get a scene that looks like it's something out of a Vietnam film.
I was going to say the exact same thing.
Yeah, go ahead. You can describe it then.
So they are approaching Blofeld's lair via helicopter, and it really does look like I can't think of the name of the movie.
Apocalypse.
Yeah,
Now.
Apocalypse Now, where it's like the three helicopters. I guess this is kind of a different setting. It's not the jungle; they're in the Alps. But
I mean, again, if you put a yellow filter on instead of a light blue filter, it's the same shot. And in fact, they keep doing the thing where they cut between the helicopters flying side by side, and then from the front and then the side, and they're approaching this base. It's, you know, it also reminds me of the old G.I. Joe cartoon where they're flying towards like. Whatever.
Cobra Command.
Like, because that's what it is. It's just, they're in this, it's called the Plaza? Plots something. I had it just in front
Blofeld's
of
Blofeld's Lair?
Yeah, it's they keep referencing that it used to be a restaurant, and now it's not a restaurant anymore. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'll find it. But if we do, like, at the end of this podcast, we do a trip of Europe from Bond's point of view, it'd be fun to visit this place, because apparently it's Piazza Gloria, which is a restaurant on top of a mountain, which is now apparently just a museum for Bond and a restaurant. But it's actually a place.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
What I did like was, as they were approaching by a helicopter and whatever air traffic controller tower contacts them, and then Draco comes up with this, they're on a mercy mission to this, like, earthquake in Italy, and it's like, get off our backs, we're delivering aid.
It was clever. This was more clever than Bond had been in the entire film so far. And actually, they went one step further. If you notice, they even had the little crosses on each helicopter.
Yeah.
So they looked
almost like they planned it.
Yeah, they looked like proper Red Cross helicopters.
As opposed to anything Bond had done to this point. and so they have this, you know, they convince them, kind of, and they're like, no, there's no record of you in Zurich. And he goes, try Geneva? And he goes, all right, we'll get back to you in 30 seconds. But by that point, they're within range, and they start their attack on Blofeld's compound. The Beauchamp Allergy Clinic, which allergies, man.
They'll get you.
And so we have the blue shirts / white shirts against the orange shirts and the Olympic Committee, I guess.
The construction workers against the Olympic Committee.
Mafia versus mafia. And Yeah, so we get an all-out assault. What do you think? This was pretty good.
Yeah, it was fun.
I thought it was pretty cool. I thought there were one too many, like, weird cuts where the lighting didn't look right.
This or movie
the sound
is full
didn't
of weird
look
cuts.
Right. Yeah, this was, like, this was a really dense bit of it for me.
Yeah.
But this was good. This is, like, when the action finally picks up.
And again, we'll forgive a lot of, like, at least I forgive a lot of crap in a movie as long as the action is good. Because if it's an action movie, it should be an action movie. This movie had a lot of, like, exposition from singular people who don't matter.
Yep.
But these action shots are fun. This is where we get Bond sliding on his chest down a hill with a gun just firing at people. We get grenades for no reason. They start shooting towards Tracy. Tracy kicks some ass for a little bit after beating up that one guy repeatedly and him coming back too. And
this is where we see the alchemist toss a vial of acid.
A granado of acid, yes.
Here, and the Bond is, you know, if this was a level, he has a mission, which is to take pictures of where all the women are going.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets pictures of five or six of them before Blofeld starts shooting at him so that he runs away and they have a shootout. With Blofeld. Presumably the rest of the women get away. I know someone's going to write in and tell me it doesn't matter because they won't hear the message. It's still a problem.
They still have vials of ridiculously toxic whatever.
And so they're going to go and try to spray the atomizer and die, I guess?
Drop it. Kill everyone.
Whoops. So this ends up with our second ski into a bobsled chasing.
Which was great.
This was great. Yeah.
Except for the bobsled thing really went on for... Everything Ever. In this movie went on forever, but...
Yeah, I don't know. Bobsled runs to the last 2 or 3 minutes, and even if you're terrible at it, probably no more than 5, or you're dead, presumably.
Yeah,
I imagine bobsledding is dangerous.
As none of us are authority on bobsledding, I think we'll leave this one be, but...
I've skied. That's it. I haven't bobsledded. Or prayed. I don't think I've done curling either. I need to do more winter sports.
I've never
curled. I've seen curling.
In person?
No, not in person. But the last Winter Olympics, that's all I watched.
I had my grandmother was, she curled.
Oh.
She was one of the broomy people. Oh. As are most of the curlers, I guess.
I guess technically, yeah.
Yeah.
You're the pusher or the broomer. Yeah. So.
But aren't there a team of broomers?
I don't know.
Yeah, there are. Well, there's at least 2 or 3.
Yeah. And then you have the one that does the thing with the curling.
The stone.
The stone.
I think it's technically a stone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The puck.
We're clearly, yes.
Yes.
Is that Lazenby on your shirt?
I don't know if it is. It looks kind of like him, but it could also just be a generic Bond silhouette.
Lazenby looks handsome. He looks like a Brooks Brothers model, I've heard someone say. But
yeah,
he was just dry. He's just no good. So they chase down the hill, Blofeld and Bond. Bond and Blofeld, you know, it's the meet cute you wanted all along. Terry Savalas has done a great job so far. They detonate the plastic explosives that they laid throughout the compound. Draco's men do. The whole thing blows up in a series of 3 shots, which are weird. One is a model that's blowing up. One is the building hole with superimposed fire on it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then the last one is a crater with the stairs leading up to it that make it look like the chateau,
yep.
The restaurant, whatever. And that's pretty much it.
Yep.
And so they start skiing down the mountain. Blofeld shoots at him. Bond shoots back. It's just adorable. Then they chase each other down and
find some bobsleds.
Bobsleds in the shed. And it's I know there's no way to describe an action scene that makes sense, but this is actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
Bond is getting close. They start shooting at each other. Bond gets knocked off it by Blofeld. He takes a shortcut around an oxbow and then ends up back on the back of it,
yep.
of Blofeld's. And they get close.
He basically cuts through the course and like jumps on Blofeld's bobsled.
And then they get back until Blofeld accidentally hangs himself on a tree.
It was very abrupt. He's just sort of...
As getting hung on a tree while moving on a...
He just sort of stands up and, oh, I've been caught in a tree branch. And we don't... And then he's out of the scene.
He's so definitively
he's,
dead.
He's been defeated.
Well, yes, he's been defaulted.
Groan.
And then the movie takes a decidedly bizarre turn.
Yeah.
The movie... There's a cold cut as Bond... is thrown clear, right, of Blofeld's It took every ounce of restraint to not make that bobsled explode.
They really wanted to.
They wanted that bobsled to explode so bad. And then Bond's bobsled kind of slides up next to him. St. Bernard comes up, runs up to him, and Bond goes, no, come back with the brandy. None of that. 5-star Hennessy, nothing less.
This should have been the joke they made 2 hours ago, but didn't.
Yes. And so presumably Bond makes it. Tracy had gotten away after her father punched her in the face to make her stop complaining.
He just knocked her out. And what was his line? Does anyone remember that line?
Spare the rod, spoil the child.
Yeah, like, are you kidding me?
Well, so this
is a grown woman.
She's trying to go back in to save Bond, and he knows it's foolish, so he jacks her and puts her in the helicopter, and they take off.
The next scene is Bond's wedding.
Yep.
Mr. and Mrs. Bond, and it's done. It's actually probably, on one hand, the best filmed and written, but it's also definitely the best written scene. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, we already made fun of the fact that M is walking off with Draco laughing about how you got away with so much gold that day. As though there's like 009 was dealing with Draco the same way Bond was dealing with Spectre, right? Like something like that. But we're all on good terms here because presumably Bond has no family. So, you know, his family is the office.
Yeah.
We have a heartrending few shots with Moneypenny, who's like on the verge of tears the whole time.
And then she chokes back. Oh, I always cry at weddings.
That poor girl.
And this is the most physical Bond has been with Moneypenny. He smacks her butt once, and I think he kisses her on the lips.
It was actually a little strange. Their relationship was too relationship-y in this one.
Yeah, and they invite each other. He invites her over for drinks.
Yeah.
It's something. It's a thing. And so she's wearing the world's largest hat, and it's so sad. Q goes, you know, we've never gotten along, really. I hate you so much. Oh, so very, very much. But if you need anything. And he goes, I think I have the only gadget I'll need. And you're just like, meanwhile, his side of the family, or I guess her side of the family, looks like the scene from The Godfather, because she's wearing this huge dress, and everyone there is like wearing the same suit with guns on, and you're just like,
okay.
M is much too okay with this. M is far, far too okay with this. It's in an adorable kind of scene. He tosses his hat to Moneypenny like he always does in the office, and she catches it and immediately starts bawling. And Q
steals it, yeah.
Swipes it right back up. And he's got no respect for government property.
And he starts dusting it off.
I have a feeling like he owned that hat. I don't think that was a government issue hat.
I do like the idea that he's issued a government hat, though. Oh, my God. Okay, and so this is probably the scene that is the most heartrending.
Yeah, and I think, you had the realization slightly before I did. I don't know if you remembered what happens in the very end, but Nick was like, oh, I remember this. And I was like, watching, and then hit me at the same time, like, oh, yes, that does happen.
Yeah.
So he's driving along in the wedding car, and it's decked out in flowers. It says just married on the back, and everyone's cheering along the road, cheering.
And I was happy because we got the Aston.
We got the Aston back finally. Yep. And then some kids that look like the Archies out of Riverdale drive by, and they're honking and they're waving and they're like, yay! And he goes, did you get her flowers? And he's like, oh, we do look like a bit of a flower shop. And so he stops to take the flower garlands off.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, Blofeld driving the car and Frau Bunt drive by with a machine gun shooting up the car. And Bond gets back in the car and realizes that Tracy has been shot clear through the forehead.
Yep.
And killed.
Yep.
After a wedding scene. Bond is married for all of 45 seconds.
Yep.
And you're like, well, of course Bond can't stay married, blah, 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 blah. You know, this one doesn't end with Bond will return in. Or might have. We were too sick to even bother watching the credits. But, you know, you think that she would survive till the next movie or something.
Nope.
Not even. They don't even pretend. Like, you don't know if there's going to be a sequel or not, but she dead.
Yep.
Yeah, she
did. We got the very, not even on. It was actually kind of well acted by Lazenby, where he was trying, like, he was kind of not having it. He was like, no, it'll be fine. We'll make it down the mountain or something.
No, I mean, she said, you know, there's something like, well, I didn't get you a gift. He goes, well, you did. You got me you. We now have all the time in the world together.
Yeah.
And she gets shot in the next moment. And then he was holding her head, and the cop's like, oh, no fornicating on the side of the road. Well, he doesn't say that. He stops to make sure they're okay. And he's holding her head because she's dead now, and he's actually crying.
Yeah.
And he goes, no, we have all the time in the world. And then there's silence. There's about 30 seconds of silence. And then the credits start. And then play
credits. Oh, yeah.
And then the Bond theme.
It was, you see the bullet hole in the windshield and da-na-da-na-da-na-na. It's like, really?
It was a twist. That was. That was the one scene that was not cliche. That was the one scene from this film that really, really made an impression, I thought.
And the problem, of course, is we know from foreshadowing that Sean Connery comes back and Diamonds Are Forever is a great movie. And he's on a bit of a rampage there.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, this is when you need your Quantum of Solace, where the whole point is that Bond is now no longer has emotions, and he's gone. But Lazenby's gone. So, like, it's just, it's such a weird one-off movie. And it's a long movie.
Yes.
This will be our shortest episode, but this is our longest movie so far. By about 10 minutes, it feels like 45.
Oh, my God.
Because this is, well, and the second longest one, I think, was Thunderball, and that one's also a slog.
Well, and I remember after watching Thunderball, we were like, oh, yeah, we could cut, you know, that 45-minute sequence. We could have cut multiple 45-minute sequences in this one.
We could have cut down people's monologues.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Everything could have been cut down, really.
Yeah, no, this is rough. I don't want to protract it any longer. Like, the most protracted part of this movie is Bond trying to get to the actual action.
Yeah.
Any thoughts? Like, I mean, final thoughts on George Lazenby, because he's gone.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I said at the beginning, I don't think he was given a fair shot, honestly. I think that this movie had so many glaring issues, and it was just so slow. It was like a... I don't even know.
No, I mean, and I agree with you, because, like, we talked on the myopia, and we'll get to them later, of course, but Pierce Brosnan has a similar problem. Like, if Goldeneye hadn't been so good and his first movie had been The World Is Not Enough or Tomorrow Never Dies, he would not have been given four movies.
Yeah.
Right? Like, this movie is just so much weaker, and, you know, Sean Connery's like, I could go for another paycheck. Fine. Come back. We'll do a better movie. This movie had a bad director. Who was clearly interested in directing certain shots, not directing an entire movie. The script was a mess. It was way too long and way too complicated, and people had entire paragraphs at a time without...
I think the script was really just the biggest massive problem with this movie.
And the sound cues were all off.
Yes. Oh, yeah, there were some dubbing issues.
Oh, yeah, there were.
I really noticed them in this movie, too, because they have been kind of bad at points in the other movies, but the dubbing was really bad in this
movie. Did you two, because I have not seen this prior to we watched the Blu-ray version, so I don't know if, are these inconsistencies?
I haven't seen it recently enough on a not Blu-ray version to say.
Because there were weird, you know, like audio things, and you think, is it just like this? Is it the version we have?
And some of the cuts were like really overly jarring.
It sounds like Blofeld's talking to me, and then you don't see him, and it sounds like he's talking through an intercom.
Yes.
Well, so, and then there's like, you know, I know at the time it was traditional to film people talking, but you would add the voice later. And there were clearly different actors and actresses that were coming in later to do this because the voices sound wrong.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, to answer Steve's question fairly, I think it's, you know, the House of Cards effect, where it probably was bad in some of the other movies, but everything else about the movie was stronger, so you forgive more. This one, it doesn't have a leg to stand on, other than those skiing sequences. But again, it has the Thunderball problem of when you add the three of them together, it's probably 40 minutes of the movie,
yeah,
or at least half an hour, and you're like, that's a lot of fucking skiing.
That's a lot of skiing.
I mean, and yeah, I give you the George Lazenby was not given a fair shake, and when Sean Connery's like, yeah, I'll come back for another one, of course you dump George Lazenby.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's Sean freaking Connery. And Lazenby's been some other stuff that's fine, but...
This was his first movie, too. I mean...
Yeah, and it's a hard role to come into, especially... No.
How did he get this, by the way?
God, I can't even imagine. You know, it's one thing if you asked me that question earlier, but... I don't know. I mean, and I guess they wanted the look, right?
Yeah, and he kind of he had the look, so...
He was a model. An unknown actor and model.
That's all I thought they needed, right?
Yeah.
Because Sean Connery's already done a wonderful job to build this role up, and he's already got notoriety, and people understand what Bond is and what Bond does. You just need the look, and you need to write a proper script to support it, which unfortunately didn't happen. But
yeah, no. He was in a 1978 movie called The Death Dimension, which looks like a kung fu movie.
I want to read this to you because that's our next why movie. Not? Yeah. So first of all, he's an Aussie, which is maybe why his accent kept going in and out. And so that's a stay tuned. So he's an Australian, and he goes, prior to appearing as James Bond, George Lazenby was a model who appeared in advertising. After refusing to do another Bond film, because this one was a train wreck, Lazenby's career stalled.
He refused.
Lazenby's career stalled in the 1970s, and he moved into business and invested in real estate. He later appeared in several films, including television series, including a role spoofing the James Bond character.
Of course.
So not to talk more about Death Dimension, it has a job in it.
No way!
Yes!
So we're definitely doing
it. It's a blaxploitation film with George Lazenby and Oddjob.
God.
And Jim Kelly.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So yeah, that's definitely happening.
Okay, so stay tuned for Death Dimension.
We're going to have to do a whole second series after we do Bond, of Bond spin-off movies
and Bond spin-off movies. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, email us in if you guys are interested in this, because we have a couple ideas for bonus episodes and, like, you know, pseudo paid content to help us raise money. So if you want to hear us do a riff of one of these movies, we have some coming up. So just email us at interest. But yeah, I think we're about done here.
Yeah.
Any last thoughts, guys? This is one I think you guys can skip.
I don't think I can add anything new in any sort of last words.
This is only for the completionist, I feel. And it makes me wonder, frankly, if they're not going to try to do something similar to the end of this with a sequel to Spectre, because the idea that Bond walks off with his love interest makes me wonder if you're not going to have another Tracy. Like, because I know in the books, the character from Spectre, the movie Spectre,
yes,
survives a while, but Tracy is Bond's true love, and she's coming up, right? Because this is the third book, and Spectre is based on the first couple. But this one, man, I can't imagine wanting to tell people to watch this.
No. There were, again, a few redeeming qualities, and there's some scenes that I liked, but you can't sit through 2.5 hours of movie for 30 minutes of enjoyable scenes.
I do love Bond in the Alps, but it's rough.
Yeah.
It's rough. Anyway, I guess then, without further ado, tune in 2 weeks as Mission Briefing returns when Bond is back in Diamonds Are Forever. Thanks, guys.
Mission Briefing and Myopia Defender Childhood are produced by Dude Letter Podcasting. It's hosted and edited by Nick Poffman. Our graphic designer is Scott Miller. The theme song is sampled from Monty Norman's James Bond theme. Questions and comments? Please visit myopiapodcast.com/missionbriefing or contact us through myopiamissionbriefing@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @missionbriefing and @myopiapodcast and find us on Facebook, Stitcher, and iTunes. And while you're on iTunes, please rate and review our podcast. Want to help us out? Go to myopiapodcast.com/Amazon and purchase stuff like normal. Myopia and Mission Briefing get a piece of the action. James Bond will return in Diamonds Are Forever.